in our computer model, the smaller type cows that produce more milk are generally more efficient. And there's no interaction between cow type and nutritional environment like there was in the Jenkins paper. In the Jenkins paper, certain cow types were more efficient at low feed intake, and certain types, different types, were more efficient at high feed intake. And we don't see that interaction in our computer model.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Mycotoxins can threaten feed and cattle performance. DSM Firmenich offers a portfolio of solutions to help mitigate the impact of mycotoxins in your feed. bioMérieux is a world leader in the field of diagnostics for more than 60 years. From pathogen detection to genomics and data applications, bioMérieux helps beef industrials going beyond the test results to help control your food safety and process risks. Virbac, committed to growth. For information, visit vet-us.verbac.com/cattle or see your Virbac representative. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit proearthanimalhealth.com today.
Welcome to the Beef Podcast. I'm Travis Molinix, and today I'm excited for the topic we have. We have Dr. Philip Lancaster from Kansas State. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Travis.
Phil, just give an overview for producers. I know you're the clinical assistant professor at K-State, which when I think of clinical, I do not think of someone that, you know, has the beef nutrition background that you do. So give the audience, you know, that background of what you do for K-State.
Yeah, so I'm in a little different situation here at K-State. I'm a trained beef cattle nutritionist. I'm not a veterinarian, but my position is in the College of Veterinary Medicine. And so the reason I have that title is that's how they have their professional titles set up here in this college. But what I do is with the Beef Cattle Institute here at K-State, and we work on lots of different things related to beef production research. And so I bring the nutrition component to this team. So we have our team involves several veterinarians, some geneticists, economists, and people focused on reproduction. And so we all work together on different projects, and I bring that nutrition component to that team.
So it's a nice systems view coming out of the vet school.
Yes. Yep.
And before that, you've had a lot of experience in other work, being at University of Florida, Oklahoma State, Missouri State as well. So you bring this, you know, wide background across all these different environments of different management, different nutritional strategies as well.
Yes. Yep. So I've had quite a bit of experience at different production systems across the southeast part of the U.S. for the most part. And I grew up in Illinois and spent some time in South Texas at A&M as well. And so seen quite a bit of different production systems and the way people handle things with different forage environments and things like that.
So it kind of leads us to the topic, and we think about beef efficiency, and you guys have done a lot of modeling work and looking at some efficiency metrics. You know, it's a very important topic when we look at, you know, where we're at today with our cost of production, and our output traits are not changing. And so efficiency is very important. Just how do we increase efficiency of the cow herds, especially when we think of the cost of our cow herds? And so you're doing some really interesting work of modeling some research that was done in the early 1990s that was really important from a nutrition standpoint. And you guys are looking at it today and modeling from cows today. Can you tell us more about this research?
First, we'll talk a little bit about that research from the 1990s, just so everybody's up to speed and familiar with that. And so that was a study that was done at USDA Mark there in Clay Center, Nebraska. And they looked at several different breeds of cows. And then they fed each breed of cows different levels of nutrition. So different levels of energy and protein over the course of the whole production cycle. And they did that over several years. And so then they looked at, well, how efficient were those cows that herd of cows, not necessarily individuals, but that herd of cows at each of those levels of nutrition. And so the thing that their measure of efficiency was grams or of calf weaned or pounds of calf weaned per pound of feed consumed. And so that takes into account then the growth potential of the animals. It takes into account the lactation of the animals to produce that calf. But then because they looked at it on a herd basis, it also takes into account the reproduction ability of those cows at different levels of feed intake. We've been looking at, and we've built over the last 5 years or so, a computer model of a cow herd that simulates a cow herd over the course of however many years I want that computer model to run. And our goal with that is trying to evaluate or trying to identify the types of cows that are best suited for nutritional environments, because that Jenkins paper from the 1990s there showed that certain breed types are more efficient in certain nutritional environments. And that really started this whole idea of matching the genetics to the nutritional environment with your cow herd. And so from a tool perspective for producers, well, how do I do that? How do I know what the right mature size is and the right milk potential is for my nutritional environment? And so we were interested in trying to build a model then that would be able to let us identify which ones are right for which nutritional environment. And that's, so that's where this kind of all started in this and where we're going with this computer model.
So really important from the aspect of, you know, from environment changes, and this is a big question a lot of guys get asked from an extension standpoint is what size of cow should I have and what level of milk? As we both know, is cow size in the United States has steadily risen, where we have monstrous cows today, and milk production has too, right? And one of my favorite sayings by Dave Lawman has been that cows milk today more than they did in the 1970s, or that dairy cows did in the 1970s.
That's a good, I hadn't heard that. Wow.
Yep. And so, you know, the research I did in Tennessee, we had cows milking over 40 pounds of milk. And if you think about the efficiency of that, of the system, that's not very efficient, because that calf can't suckle 40 pounds of milk. But she's eating 240 pounds of milk to produce that, right? And so that's a very inefficient system. Of trying to optimize where should I be, and across these environments due to different nutritional and, you know, forage types, that's going to change. But it's very hard for a producer to say what is optimal for my environment.
Yeah. And so you think about the efficiency of that from an energetic efficiency. It's not very efficient for that cow to produce all that milk to feed the calf. But she's turning something that has a low energy value in forage to something that has a high energy value in milk. There's got to be an optimal. And we haven't been able to figure out how to find that optimal.
Yeah, and it's very tough, especially in milking. It's very tough because no producer can milk cows, right? And we may do that from a research standpoint, but it's hard when they ask you, where should I be for milk? And it's hard to tell them.
Yeah, because, I mean, our estimate of milk from a genetic standpoint is based on the weaning weight of the calf.
Right.
And if the cow's producing more than the calf can consume, then he's not really showing her, that weaning weight is not really showing her genetic potential for milk.
Yeah, and I think we're getting more and more into that of having those really high milk producing cows, but not see, and that's why we haven't seen that change in weaning weight in the United States in the last 20 years, is we've got that genetic potential. We just don't have the forage base to support it.
Mm-hmm.
From the modeling of re-looking at the Jenkins 94 paper, so what's your data showing from modeling from that cow herd that you're working with?
So in our computer model, the results are interesting in that they don't match what the Jenkins paper with actual cows showed, where in our computer model, the smaller type cows that produce more milk are generally more efficient. And there's no interaction between cow type and nutritional environment like there was in the Jenkins paper. In the Jenkins paper, certain cow types were more efficient at low feed intake, and certain types, different types, were more efficient at high feed intake. And we don't see that interaction in our computer model. And our computer model is based on the latest information that we have from the nutrient requirements for beef cattle, the NRC that everybody uses to evaluate nutrition and genetic merit for cows. And so our question is, okay, well, what's missing? What do we not understand, or what do we not have in that NRC that is not allowing us to model that interaction?
Yeah, that's interesting. And you know, the cows in 1996, and that's early 90s, and cows today are totally different, right? They're a totally different beast today as they were then. And so it really needs to be redone. And that's why I'm excited about this modeling work, because that leads to more of that research of validating this again, because those cows are totally different. And so using this data is nearly not appropriate for our cows today.
Yeah, and so it begs the question, how valid are some of these NRC equations for our cow genetics today? And is it that, or is there some biological piece that we're not able to model with the information that we have today?
So what makes your data different than Jenkins? What does it look like compared to the Jenkins?
So one of the things that is interesting is that as the intake went up, as the feed availability went up, efficiency actually tended to go down, whereas in the Jenkins paper, efficiency tended to go up, at least for those highly productive or high growth potential breeds. Production went, or efficiency went up as intake went up. And so we didn't see that. Every cow type that we evaluated, all the way from a 1,000-pound cow to a 1,600-pound cow, all had the same trend. As intake went up, efficiency went down. There was no added benefit to growth potential. The big question is why?
Right. From a mechanistic standpoint, you know, what would be driving that difference that, from a, you know, biology, what's driving that difference that as intake goes up, efficiency, you're not seeing that efficiency?
I think, you know, it could be it, because we're looking at reproduction as well as part of this, is that we're not seeing a huge difference in reproduction rates at different levels of intake in our model. So that could be part of it. Where our model does adjust reproductive rates based on body condition scores. So the cows that are getting less feed should have dropped off in body condition score. But here's the interesting thing is the ones at the lower feed intake level maintained pretty good body condition scores of 4 or 5. The ones at the high feed intake level actually got really fat in our model. They got it up to body condition scores 8 and 9. And we had cows in there with body fat of over 40% in some of the simulations. And so my first thing is our models are not making a good enough adjustment for maintenance requirements of some type to where that level of feed intake isn't changing body condition like it should be.
It also reminds me of dry lot rations for cows. Is, you know, you lock cows up and it's easy to get them fat on a very low quality diet. And so, you know, you change that behavior or grazing behavior, you decrease activity, and it's really easy to get cows fat very quickly. And so it reminds me, and they will eat more than you suspect once you lock them up too. And so it kind of reminds me of dry lot dill. If you got ad lib in a dry lot, you're going to have very fat cows. And so that kind of makes me think of that when you talk about as intake goes up, you lose efficiency and cows get really fat.
And so that could be part of it because our model doesn't take into account that activity level. As you know, Travis, there are equations in the NRC to try to estimate activity level for cattle on pasture and things like that. But they're not very precise and not. So we did not incorporate those into the model. And so maybe that's part of it, is that activity level is a lot higher in cattle out on pasture than we think it is. And so that's increasing their energy requirements that we're not accounting for in the model.
And that's a very tough one. And it's really driven by environment of, as you've been in the Southeast, you know, cows don't have to move far to get all they want.
Yeah.
Right. And then you go to, your Western United States is cows got to travel a long distance per day to get that same consumption level.
Uh-huh. And then I can't remember who was on the paper, but it was right around 2014, 2015, but I think it was some folks at Fort Kehoe in Montana evaluated the NRC equations for cows out on range,
yep.
And they said, they said, it doesn't do a very good job, but part of that study was, but cows adapt to that environment to where their requirements aren't all that much different than what you would think for cows.
I was actually a co-author on that paper And so we did. We looked at cows in Tennessee. It was when I was on faculty at Tennessee. So I had data from Tennessee, New Mexico, Montana, and Oregon. And we predicted that response. And, it actually predicted fairly well in Tennessee outside of milk. And it was my underestimation of the amount of milk that they were producing that got us off. But when you get in the Western United States, it did not predict energy requirements very well because of a lot of it may have been cows are walking 10, 12 miles per day. And so that's a large activity that they're expending.
And so, and part of that paper, if I remember, part of it, they were thinking about the environmental, temperature and stuff like that. And I guess that didn't seem to be a big part from what I remember. The cows had adapted and that didn't really have as much impact as we thought that it would.
No, it didn't. And so we kind of ignored it for most part because it didn't have that big of an impact on their requirements.
So that may be part of, we need to incorporate more information on and get some better models of how much activity are these cattle really and how much energy are they expending?
Well, that just leads to how complicated this is, right? So we got activity, we have cold stress, weather stress. And, pen studies are great to get some of that base data. But once you get out of the pen, it gets very hard to get really high quality data to help predict these things.
Yeah. And so one of the next steps that we're taking from a maintenance requirement perspective, as I haven't dove into the activity side of things, but looking at body composition better and we use a static number for maintenance requirements. And so we're looking at trying to better predict maintenance requirements based on body composition, both of just fat and protein, but also visceral organ mass, and trying to evaluate, we know how visceral organ mass changes with diet and things like that, but we're trying to put some numbers to it and build an equation that we can add to this model and adjust energy requirements based on the type of diet that they're eating and how that affects the size of the GI tract and things like that. And then how does that change in body condition score impact their maintenance energy requirements?
I mean, there's a lot of research that can go into this of trying to fine tune it. And it's one of those that in your career, you're always going to be chasing, how can we fine tune this, right?
Yeah, see, this is job security for me. And that's our goal. We want to, how good can we get it and how good does it need to be to be effective in trying to evaluate cow types in nutritional environment?
So what's the next step of how are y'all putting in actual data, or are y'all looking for, you know, collaborators that have large data sets of cows in different environments that have certain data? What's the next steps of how to better model this for you guys?
Well, we could, lots of different things. Yeah, we would be interested in collaborators that have large data sets. From that maintenance engine requirement perspective, right now I've got a couple of students who are building data sets from the literature and looking at building equations from that. But having some real data sets to validate and maybe to build and fine tune the model with would be great. It'd be really great to have that original data set from the Jenkins paper, some of that kind of stuff. But if anybody's got stuff out there that they're interested in collaborating on, we'd be willing and happy to be part of that.
Great. So, you know, what do you think is driving some of this differences in efficiency? Outside of the modeling work, when you think of cow efficiency, what's driving some of these differences in efficiency?
Well, so, you know, how much of it's feed intake driven? Cows that just eat more than you expect based on their body size and things like that. You know, we've gotten some from the work that's been done anyway in growing animals and even cows in confinement. We know we've got some pretty big differences in the intake capacity of different cows and probably different genetic lines and things like that. So we get cows that are eating more than we expect. And like you said, milk, we got cows that are producing over 40 pounds of milk at peak milk. That's a lot. And so obviously, you know, calf can't consume that much. And so that's kind of a waste in some regards. So that's a waste of energy and an inefficiency there. Dr. Lallman talks a lot about the muscle mass that we've increased the energy requirements of our cow types because we have added ribeye area and muscle mass to these genetic lines. And so their maintenance requirements are higher than what we would expect.
Yeah. You know, all of those taking count back to the cow, you know, we may not be seeing that from a cow-calf standpoint when we sell it weaning, but all that genetic potential of increased lean mass, increased growth, you know, the feedlots love it because they're getting that genetic potential.
And if you, you know, Travis, if you look at, I'll say, and this is back to modeling work, but if you model efficiency of a cow-calf production system, selling at weaning, small cows almost always win when you look at that. But if you model it to slaughter of the calf, large cows always win because of that feedlot phase and the increased efficiency of that animal in the feedlot. And so, I mean, to me, it's not surprising why our industry has gone that way, because from a whole industry perspective, that just, it just makes sense that that's the most efficient animal. But when I don't retain ownership of that calf through the feedlot, I've got a lot of feed and maintenance expense in that cow that I'm not gaining benefits from.
And that's tough for so many producers, is that they're selling at weaning and to increase cow size and not get that benefit is a huge loss to them. But down the stream, you know, the system's losing out. And so I see both arguments, and you know what the industry is doing right now of increasing carcass weights, and there has been no signal to back down. And it's been full force to increase carcass weights. And that's going to increase cow size continue on. And so I don't know what we're averaging today, but it has to be over 1,500 pound cows in the United States. And it's scary of what that's going to do in the next 5-10 years if we continue with increased carcass weights.
Yeah, continue to get bigger and bigger. And I mean, how big can we really get? How big is too big? At some point the system's going to have a problem.
But it goes back to your comments of modeling this from the standpoint of efficiency of optimizing the systems, right? And there's give and takes in that. And smaller cows may not always be the best, and that cow-calf producers could increase their cow size some to increase some of that. So there's a give and take.
Yeah. So from a computer model standpoint, I say small cows always seem to win, but in the real world, small dumpy calves at the sale barn don't bring very much, you know? And so there is an optimum. You can't just go to the far extremes one way or the other.
Yeah. The optimal would be a genetic line that produce smaller heifers, but larger steers. Right? Yeah. So that would be optimum, is that, you know, cow size wouldn't go up because your replacement heifer size are not increasing. Mm-hmm. But you're increasing that yearling weight of those steers and increase them going into that feedlot.
Yeah. And that, you know, that terminal cross or crossbreeding would be, but it's tough for a lot of guys to do when our average cow herd in the U.S. is only, you know, 40 head or something like that. That becomes difficult for guys to do.
Well, Bert Tykert's always said that if you have less than 300 head, then you should be a terminal breed. And which makes a lot of sense, right? Of not keeping those replacement heifers. And that's one thing that's not taken full advantage of the United States as terminal systems. Mm-hmm. So is crossbreeding, but that's one thing that really could help with increasing that output.
Yep. And being able to balance efficiency in the cow-calf stage and efficiency in the feedlot phase.
Well, Phil, have we missed anything that you want to touch on?
I don't think so, Travis. I think there's a lot to learn here yet. I think it's interesting that our nutrition models don't do kind of what we would expect them to, or what the biology says in this regard. And so from a research standpoint, it's always lots of, now I got some fun questions to try to answer.
Now you got some really cool data. I'm looking forward to seeing some of these posters that your students have and seeing this research come out.
Thanks, Travis.
It's time for our famous three.
Well, thanks for the time. A lot of good stuff here, a lot of benefit to the audience, a lot of interesting research coming out of K-State right now.
Yeah, thank you.
So I've got three questions to end us up. And so the first one will be, you know, what is your highly recommended beef book or website that you recommend someone utilizing?
I'll say the probably one of the things that I think can be very helpful for guys a little bit is the U.S. Roundtable for Sustainable Beef's website. They've got some good information on there about how to improve land and water resources and efficiency and things like that. And so they got some good information on there and some tools that you can use to assess your operation. So I think that's a good wheat resource for producers out there.
No, that's a great resource for producers, especially learning some of those metrics that they should be looking at. So what's a non-beef book that you highly recommend someone reading?
I guess I'd say I've got two boys, 10 and 12, and as being a dad, so I'm, you know, some books on fatherhood and things like that. And there's a book called Raising Dad, and it's a pretty good book on just how your kids see you, and building that relationship with your boys. So I think that's a good one.
That's a great recommendation. So lastly, what sets apart a successful beef professional, in your opinion?
I think one of the things, I tell this to students graduating and things like that, and this was something that I was not very good at when I was coming out of school and didn't really think about, but it's networking and being open to talking to whoever. Even though you might not think that you have anything in common or whatever. I think that skill is very important for success of professionals in the beef industry, especially moving forward. And, and all the collaborations and networking connections that are needed to be successful in today's industry.
No, it's a great recommendation. It's not always what you know, it's who you know that gets you places. And it's networking is very important.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
All right. Well, thanks for the time and jumping on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Travis. I appreciate it. It's fun.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.